So this is introductory biology BioSci 101, Wednesday, December 3rd, 2008. Are there any questions before we start today? We're going to do almost exactly the same thing we did on Monday, but with a different subject. So yes. So this is a very good question. That is, if you do your papers with someone else, do you need to make two copies? And yeah, make one for your portfolio, but you only need to turn in one to me. And so, yeah, but everybody, you know, look at that one, look at that portfolio that's up on Blackboard. It's a PDF file. If you don't have Acrobat Reader, you can download it free. Do it at 3 in the morning, and there's not nearly as much traffic on the interstate. But put your look at that sample. Question is, all these papers that we write in these last 2 weeks, should they go in the portfolio? I'm not going to say, you know, you don't get your portfolio points if you don't have those in. No. What are they? What do they represent? I'm tempted to just spend this whole 30 minutes talking about college. I really am. How many of you would like to hear this? This is what I've learned from your parents, okay, and all of their descendants for the last 42 years. So the question is, do we need to put these last six writings in our portfolio? What do they really represent? From a faculty's perspective, they represent a very creative experiment in higher education. And before you all start feeling like you're fruit flies or lab rats, I should assure you that across the country, everybody who finds himself or herself in front of one of these large auditoriums is asking exactly the same kinds of questions. How do I do this in an educational way? How do I accomplish the higher education ideals in this setting? How do I deal with not only 200 people like are in this room or 265 as are in the class before us, but in many of those institutions where there are rooms like this with 500, 700, or 1,000 students in, and they are all asking exactly the same question. How do I do this? And we all have our ideas about how we do this. So one of the things that I hear constantly from my colleagues around the country is the issue of what happens when you put up a PowerPoint show. For example, what takes place when you see this? And what takes place in the minds of the student, what takes place in the total intellectual equipment of a student when this goes up on the screen and when it goes through slide after slide after slide after slide, a lot of which is writing, for example, text. What happens? What's going on in terms of preparing a bunch of 18, 19, and 20-year-olds to 10 years from now buy houses, buy cars, be parents, vote, run for office, establish businesses, all of this stuff? What am I doing now? What effect is this having? And the answers range from none to very little. Every person you talk to, unless they are a real champion of distance ed and instructional technology, will tell you that PowerPoint is a real frustrating medium in the sense that it is so much fun to make these shows, and when you start preparing for class and spend 4 or 5 hours actually making 40 minutes worth of lecture, it's kind of fun because you're sitting there playing with pictures and playing with text and playing with designs, and this is a fun human activity. There is virtually nothing in students' notebooks of substance at the end of that class period. Virtually nothing. So y'all are a little better in that regard than the average large class for a couple of reasons. First of all, there are probably 25 or 30 students in here, maybe not that many, who are in a learning community, and the organization of a learning community tends to promote certain kinds of academic behavior, and that is very noticeable when I read your papers. Secondly, you've been asked to actually write stuff every Friday for the last 14 weeks, and as the semester has gone by, or what, 13 now? As the semester's gone by, some of you, and I would say probably about half of you, are getting noticeably better at it. And not only that, you're telling me that you're getting noticeably better at it. So you're about 2 years away. At this rate, you're about 2 years away of where your parents were before the internet, before text messages, before cell phones, and just before instructional technology, before you could get everything you wanted from Wikipedia, before all that stuff, you know. So you're about 2 years at the rate you're going away from your parents. I'm not saying that in a mean, nasty, or judgmental way. What I'm saying that in the way, I'm just saying it's not your fault, folks. You were born into a world of technology. You were given that technology. The institutions that you go to, that you pay tens of thousands of dollars to prepare you for the next 50 years, those institutions buy into that technology, big deal, because it makes them look sort of sophisticated. And in some ways, they really are. And clearly, there are some subjects that go for which instructional technology of this type is really effective and really good. Biology is not one of them, simply because it's such a complex discipline. It is fed upon and parasitizes all these other scientific disciplines. And in fact, we ought to be able to take that textbook that you bought, open it at random, and start therein. And if you go back to that first picture, I think maybe one of the first few pictures that we showed here of the pelican, then you realize that just open up those first few pages of your book, close your eyes, put your finger on that pelican page, and you could start looking at the world of life either up from that point or down from that point. So your book is organized from the bottom up, but ultimately it wouldn't make any difference. You would still come out of here 14, 15 weeks hence with, as a little biologist, if it were done correctly. So these last 6 days are part of a real experiment that says, what does the average student remember from a PowerPoint show that he or she has just listened to for 30 minutes? What does that student remember? How does that translate? And so that's one way to look at it. The other way to look at these writings is that they are indeed part of everything you've done this semester. And if you're inclined to assemble everything you've done this semester in one binder, and after the semester's over, stick it away in your closet at home. And what will happen if you're anything like our children is that 10 years from now, your mother will say, "When are you going to get your stuff?" And then 20 years from now, your mother will say, "You know, you have your own house now. Would you like your stuff?" And 30 years from now, your parents will say to your children, "Tell your mom and dad to get their stuff." And then at some point, you will go home to clean out those parents' house after they've died. And you will find your stuff. Okay? and it will be your record of what you've done on earth, and you will look at that and you'll say, you know, that was an interesting exercise, putting all of my stuff together for the first time in my life. And there might also, you know, be somewhere in there a CD that has some of these audio presentations on it. And you might pull that out and say, you know, I listened to that in a fairly critical way and was able to understand it, what it was saying to me. And suddenly, these politicians don't make nearly so much sense. And these strident sound bites that I hear on talk radio don't make nearly so much sense to me now that I've gone through the exercise of actually listening to science and then writing down my interpretation of what I've heard. So that's a very, very long, convoluted answer to a very simple question. I do try very hard to give classes like this feedback. I was able to do that earlier in the semester on your writing. I'm still working on the one that I need to get to in the next day or two. And I also try very hard to give all students, all classes like this, an end of the semester sort of summary of my reaction to them. I'll do that and I'll send it to you. It'll probably be during the Christmas vacation. What that will say, one of the things that will say, however, is I've been surprised at your preoccupation with rules and regulations and compliance and details. And I find that a little depressing because higher education is obsessed with rules and propriety and compliance. You know, absolutely. I get on the phone. Well, the phone rings. I pick it up. It's my sister-in-law that lives in Oklahoma. Hi, John. Well, how are you doing, Dolores? How are you going? Oh, I was out somewhere and ran into these gals. Gals, oh my God. It's a forbidden word. So this is the difference between Oklahoma and the compliance environment in which people like me operate day to day to day. You know? And I've been really surprised at y'all in that regard. And remember that in July, I sit down and make out a syllabus, because by that time I have a textbook, and I put it up on Blackboard for people who want to look at it. And then I start getting feedback, and I start modifying this course based on the looks on your faces, how many of you are paying attention, whether you're writing anything down. I read through all those information sheets that you give me, find out who's actually in my class, where you come from, what your backgrounds are, whether you've ever been to a museum, what kind of stuff you're reading. And I sort of shape the lecture based on that, and, you know, early in the semester. Then I start reading your stuff. 600 pages a week I read of your stuff, and to various kinds of questions, responses. And I think, okay, here I'm getting feedback on who these people are and how they're processing information and what's going through their minds, what kind of an audience I'm looking at. And then I look at the first exam scores, and I try to get a sense of what kind of a class I'm looking at, simply because I've been looking at these kinds of classes for a long time, and I know what kind of questions go up on the exams, and I know what kind of questions I get asked, and so I do that. And then I adjust our schedule accordingly. Every single day is an adjustment, really, based on questions I get asked, questions that I get asked by email, questions that are up on Blackboard. I also study the item analysis that I get back from the grading center, and I go through those, and they tell me how many students answered this one correctly, how many students answered that one correctly. This question is a good discriminator of good students versus those who are struggling. This is an easy question, this is a hard question, this is a meaningless question. They give me all of this stuff. And so, you know, I process all that, and every single day of class is modified accordingly. And there are a whole lot of people in my position, especially senior faculty members across the country, who do this and who feel like they have the time to do it. The other thing, one of the reasons I have that time is that my lab is full of good students working to make me famous. You know, you met one of them, Gabe, and Krista is another, and there are a bunch of others. So, the other thing about these kinds of classes is that in next September, everybody who comes into this university as a starting first semester student will be required to take 10 general education, so-called ACE courses, at least 10. And so all your advisors who deal with your little brothers and sisters when they come to school next year are going to encounter this set of rules and regulations. And the faculty has been arguing for 2.5 years over what ought to go in those kinds of courses. And last fall's 101 class, I tried to answer that, at least in my own way. And this semester, again, I tried to follow that experiment in a little more sophisticated way. Your writing and your follow-ups. So if this were a real ACE course, like it will be a year from now, then I would pick out four of you from after the first exam. I would pick out four of you. Two of you in the top 10%, two of you in the middle 20%, or the middle third. And I would contract with you to give me all your stuff, because all that stuff would then be converted into a PDF file and put on file for when somebody wants to evaluate and assess my course and my instruction 4 years from now, which is going to happen. Your names will be taken off, so it'll be in there. And somebody will be able to say, this is what happens. This is the best evidence we have for what's going on in the minds of 18, 19, and 20-year-olds in a class like this, in this setting. So that's a long response to your question. I will tell you some other stuff, as long as we're talking about intellectual endeavor. Right now, it's Wednesday, and your 20-point Sheldon papers are due on Monday. There are 195 people that I know of still registered in this class, and as of today, an hour ago, there were 71 people who had actually turned in their slips to Sheldon Security. Okay? That means that there are well over 100 of you who either forgot to do it, couldn't read the instructions, didn't read the instructions, didn't think it was important to read the instructions, didn't think it was important to validate that you had actually been to work that hour, even when you weren't required to, or you've decided you don't need to get this serious piece of writing done until this weekend. I love you dearly, folks, but those of you who are thinking that way, you're just dead wrong. This writing this semester has been, these are among the easiest and cheapest points available on campus, especially in science courses. All you have to do is do exactly the same thing that every productive human being I know does. Get up and go to work. Do your work day in and day out. Do it to the extent you've been asked to do it, and acquire, assemble, and retain the proof that you have done your work. Everybody that I know of that's successful on earth does that every day, habitually. And if you let yourself get caught up in it, you'll end up being a workaholic, of course. But nevertheless, that's one of the secrets to success. So, as a person who has written literally thousands of published pages literally thousands. Well, maybe not that many. Probably, right now, I think there are probably 2,000 to 3,000 pages of my own writing published and in print in the world's libraries. On the basis of that experience alone, I'm telling you, you had 2 weeks to do this work. You can't do it in 2 days. You have to go over there and take it seriously. This is a freebie, folks. This is a freebie. Go over there and take it seriously. For example, one of the reasons that you get sent over there, there are actually two reasons. One of them, you know, one of them is that it is a campus resource full of biological material. So we've used all three of the big campus resources this semester. We've used campus vegetation, even though it's all contrived and most of it is European. We've used Morrill Hall, that sits there full of biological material, good teaching stuff, day in and day out. Now we're using the Sheldon Gallery, also full of lots and lots of materials in which people have viewed and used biological materials in very creative ways as part of an effort to actually express their own creativity, but also perhaps say something individual. This is what writers do. This is what artists do. This is what poets do. They're actually either arrogant or delusional enough so that they believe they have something to say to the world. So they sit down and make these kinds of things right here, which is Albert Bierstadt. I don't know. I don't think the Sheldon's Bierstadt is up. But this is one of the most famous names in American art from the late years of the 19th century. I bring this up because it's full of plants, just like some of the stuff y'all have been writing about, some of you at least, all semester long. For those of you that have ever been issued a little paint box and, you know, and a glass of water and a piece of paper to do some watercolors on, here's a Thomas Moran watercolor. This one, I think, is framed and hanging in the lodge at Mammoth Springs in Yellowstone National Park. One of the reasons you get sent to Sheldon, aside from the fact that this is a major resource full of biological imagery, is that you also are ravenous consumers of creativity. You may not think of it that way, but you are ravenous consumers of style, of video, of movies, of advertising. Your generation sucks it up. And if you're a business person who is representing some manufacturer, the first question you ask is, how do we tap into that 15 to 22-year-old demographic? Because they are the ones who are spending the money, talking their parents into spending the money. So the whole idea of the populace as consumers of creativity is, you know, that's one of the reasons you get sent over there. Now, you're no different in that regard than American citizens of the late 1800s. It's just that the manifestation of that creativity does not come over YouTube or advertising or in the movies. It came in the form of art. And what was that art saying, by and large, to the American people? And what did the American people, how did they respond? So that art, like Bierstadt said, our nation is a frontier of beauty and glory. It is a magnificent, far-reaching frontier. Okay? And Thomas Moran, with his little paint set and his watercolors, for those of you who ever tried it, these paintings were instrumental, if not the factor, in the establishment of Yellowstone as the first national park. The symbol, Yellowstone as the symbol of our nation, its grandeur, its natural beauty, and its mysticism. So how many of you in this room have been to Yellowstone National Park? Raise your hand. How many of you in this room have went to Mammoth Springs and went in that building and saw these pictures? So what you're seeing is the imagery that established the American vision of itself, the frontier and the frontiersman. Okay? That is a perception of your nation that holds true today. We are a nation of frontiersmen. I'll admit that the next minute, maybe 2 minutes of commentary, is all personal opinion. And I'll go back to scholarly endeavor. One of the reasons that this ditz from Alaska actually got any credibility at all is that she arrived on the American stage as a frontiersman from our last frontier, Alaska. So in the minds of those who actually accepted this individual, who has less foreign experience than at least 80 of you all, has had a passport shorter time than at least 80 of you, and never made the grades that at least 100 of you are making in this course, could come within a heart attack of being the individual with a finger on a nuclear weapon. And the allure of this, in my personal opinion, is based on the sense that we are still this grand frontier symbolized by this kind of art. So what do you... Oh, I know what I need to do. Here we go, folks. Let's get back to this. So I think I made this particular... I forgot. This thing just came. Oh, this is October's issue of Art in America. And the minute I saw this come into our house, I looked at it and said, wow, those are amoeba shells. And so I thought what I'd do is just come back and show you some of this. Okay, these are drawings by Ernst Haeckel, who was known in the late 1800s as Darwin's bulldog. So this is the German scientist who actually was an oceanographer, as much as anything else, and took a round-the-world cruise studying the ocean's fauna in the late 1800s and drew all these pictures of all things, shell amoebas. And so these are oceanic amoebas. So the whole idea that if you, somehow or another, the pictures of what you see shape kind of your sense of the universe that you're looking at. So the question is, what's an ocean? You know? Well, it's salt water. Well, it goes a long, long, long way. It's cold in some places. In other places, it's fun. If you're not careful, try to surf those waves, you're going to break your neck. Okay? It's a good place to step on a stingray. But the ocean is always also a place that is literally filled with this kind of crystalline beauty. So that fact in itself is not necessarily very important, but the idea that somebody can make an observation, translate that observation into a picture, says to you that phenomenon that I'm looking at, that I'm calling an ocean, is not exactly what I perceive it to be. The world is not necessarily exactly like I perceive it to be. The world is more complicated. It's richer. There's more stuff there than I knew. And some of it is really mysterious. So that's, you know, that's the kind of thing that the Haeckel drawings show you. Plus the fact that that's no Bio 101 drawing. So, what do you want to write about today, folks? No, that was probably not very nice of me. Now, the writing... Let's change the writing prompt, okay? Let's change the writing prompt. So, as soon as you get these... If I can have your attention a minute. As soon as you get these, we will figure out another prompt.